This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 184 was recorded on September 12th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the only podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, which I highly recommend. We've got a really special feature interview for this week. Jeff Snyder and Luke Grohman have both expressed outspoken views on the U.S. dollar in their Macro Voices All-Stars appearances, but their views are so nuanced and intricate that many listeners have been left struggling to understand exactly where Luke and Jeff agree and where they disagree. So for this week's feature interview, we have both Luke and Jeff together in one place, taking a deep dive into the subject of the global U.S. dollar liquidity shortage. What exactly is the problem with the U.S. dollar? What caused it? And what other problems are being caused by it? And how likely is monetary policy to do anything meaningful to fix it? I think you're really going to enjoy this one, folks. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview. As promised last week, Patrick has prepared a slide deck to discuss commodity cycles, where we stand currently, and what might be on the horizon.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump right into the S&P 500, which is a stone's throw away from 52-week highs. What's your feeling? Are we going higher from here?
Patrick, as our regular listeners know, I've been predicting for several weeks that Trump and Xi will eventually kiss and make up, and that when that happens, we could easily see new all-time highs, even though I personally think valuations are already crazy too high at these lofty levels. Well, we got a hint that a deal may be in the works, and already we're above 3,000. I won't be the slightest bit surprised if we spike to new all-time highs on news of the actual deal, assuming that that's what's coming. Although I will throw in a caveat there, I'm not sure what the next catalyst would be to take the market the next leg higher after that. So I almost wonder if maybe there's a potential that we get some kind of high right after the news comes, and maybe it's downhill from there. But the really big news this week in the equity markets is what some people are calling the quant quake. Now, Louis Gav is going to be speaking at length in this in an All-Stars appearance on Monday, so I don't want to steal his thunder too much. But briefly, what happened at the beginning of this week was there was a sudden and extreme dislocation in prices between value and growth stocks. Now, on the surface, it seems like the averages all closed pretty much about where they were the day before. It didn't look like anything happened. I think that the metaphor here is what could be a tidal wave moving underneath the surface where nobody notices it until it gets close to the beach. Something really crazy is going on driving that. A lot of people are talking about it. Let's save the rest on that one for Louis Vincent Gav on Monday's All-Stars appearance.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index. We've got quite a bit of volatility here on the ECB. What's your thinking on the dollar here?
Well, we saw another spike above 99 on the ECB easing, and it seems like Mario Draghi had the market where he wanted it for all of about 20 minutes, and then everything retraced. We're back down only to where we were yesterday on the dollar, and I still think that the ingredients are all there for this to continue to move higher. Now, needless to say, Jeff Snyder and Luke Grohman have disagreed on whether the direction should be higher or lower. I'm personally in Jeff Snyder's camp, but let's save the bulk of this conversation for the feature interview, because that's going to be our main topic this week.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because just a few days ago, it looked like we were heading up to 60 and a very rapid reversal here. First of all, how did the inventory numbers come in, and what's your take here on what's going on in oil?
Well, the inventories were another significant drawdown in crude oil, 6.9 million barrel drawdown, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 798,000 barrels. Still a pretty significant draw, but not as big as those 2.5 million barrel draws that we saw a few weeks ago. Gasoline drawing down 682,000 barrels. Distillates, though, building 2.7 million barrels. U.S. production steady at 12.4 million barrels, holding strong there. Imports, 6.7 million barrels. Exports, 3.3 million barrels. But the really big news was not driven by inventory. It was Steve Bolton being fired by President Trump. There was an instantaneous but modest price drop on the news when it broke out on Tuesday. But the really big wholesale liquidation occurred on Wednesday when rumors came out that the reason for Bolton's firing is that President Trump was mulling the possibility of easing Iranian sanctions. And apparently there was some kind of rift between Trump and Bolton. And needless to say, Trump reverted to his favorite line, "You're fired." So the message, or at least the way the market is interpreting it, is that there has been a dramatic de-escalation of risk of a military conflict between the United States and Iran. I think the market is really discounting a lot of Iranian oil either coming back online or at least the war risk coming out of the marketplace. Now, are those things really true? It remains to be seen. But so far, the tape action has been straight down for the last couple of days, and it's all been in reaction to John Bolton's departure from the White House. I apologize, by the way, for the fact it's now been 4 weeks without an Energy Week podcast. It wasn't intentional. Actually, the first 2 weeks were an intentional holiday for our production staff. Then we had a global outage last week with the Zencaster system we used to produce that podcast. And then this week, we had two panelists called away at the last minute with travel obligations. We did manage to get Anas Al-Haji in Riyadh to give us a All-Stars interview just to get a quick oil market update that was published on Wednesday afternoon. So look for that in your Macro Voices feed. And we plan to be back next week with Anas Al-Haji, Pat Hemsworth, and Ole Hansen for a full-length Macro Voices Energy Week episode next Wednesday.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because it looks like at least at minimum a short-term high is in on bullion, and we're going through some sort of a consolidation. What's your feeling here on what's in store next for gold?
Well, the way I see this chart pattern, Patrick, is the same pattern keeps on repeating, which is we're too much, too far, too fast, overdone to the upside. It's time for a significant pullback and, I think, better buying opportunities at lower prices. But every time we see that start to really get going and it looks like the chart is really looking like the bottom's about to fall out, we're moving to those lower prices where there's going to be a better opportunity, all of a sudden some kind of news hits the tape and gold surges dramatically higher, and higher for good reason. Crazy stuff is happening in the world. So I think the big picture here, clearly, the gold bull market is on. This move has been phenomenal. We've seen a lot of moves in the last couple of weeks where gold and the dollar were up on the same day. So it seems that that dollar correlation that I had been concerned about presenting a headwind for the gold market is not going to be an issue. I still think that we're overdue for a pullback and that we will see better buying opportunities. I was surprised, though, when the Iran news came out, you know, huge, huge drop in oil, and gold was down, but not as much as I would expect, considering how much geopolitical risk was perceived to have come out of the system with the news of John Bolton's departure. If we keep having more of these news upsets, though, pushing gold higher, anything is possible. Alex Gurevich, our friend, the hedge fund manager in San Francisco, heard our interview with Grant Williams, where I was lamenting about having gotten the call wrong when I said I thought that the dollar was going to move higher. That was proven right, but my expectation was the result would be a headwind for gold. That didn't happen. Alex Gurevich is itching to tell us what I was missing and why I and a lot of other people kind of didn't get the equation right, according to Alex. We're going to try to schedule that sometime next week with Alex Gurevich.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because clearly we've seen some sort of a turn. Is this a major turn, or is this just backfilling a very overbought Treasury bond market?
I think it's a correction, and it's a buyable correction, and I bought it yesterday, as a matter of fact. I bought 10-year Treasury futures priced to yield 1.78. I don't think that this is necessarily over yet. You know, even though this is now 30 basis points off of the lows, we're still, you know, this has been a huge move down. We're less than a 38.2% Fib retracement on the big move. So we could easily back up to 2% on the 10-year before we'd have to really question, okay, is it really a correction or has there been a trend reversal? I think all the fundamentals are still there for lower yields. Right now, we're seeing a lot of optimism that maybe the world's not coming to an end and Trump and Xi are going to make a deal. I think Trump and Xi will make a deal, but I don't think that that means that all of a sudden our economic problems are going to go away. So I do think that we're still got lower yields to come, and I'm buying here, but I may have been a little bit early.
Okay, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's feature interview stars both Jeff Snyder and Luke Roman. Now, Eric, why did we invite both Jeff and Luke on for a show together this week?
We've got a ton of listener feedback just saying, look, these are both obviously brilliant guys, but my head is spinning listening to these guys. I can't even keep straight whether they agree with each other, you know, violently or disagree violently. Which is it? And help me sort this out. Give me context. So what we did is we asked Jeff and Luke, they had a long phone call ahead of time to sort of plan out how to best talk these issues through to make clear what things they agree on, which is quite a few, actually, and where they disagree. And I think this is going to bring some clarity to what it is that we're talking about when we talk about this U.S. dollar problem, the global liquidity crisis for the U.S. dollar. What exactly do we mean by that? Why is it that Jeff Snyder and I are both expecting the dollar index to move higher in coming months? Why is it that Luke isn't expecting that? That's what this interview is designed to make clear, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. This special episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. You'll often hear me say that even if I have conviction about a market or trade, you have to listen to what the market is telling you, not what you think it should be doing. And that's exactly what trend-following managers have been doing for decades with great success. These are rules-based strategies that remove human emotions and therefore can be well-researched and tested. And there's one podcast that covers trend-following strategies better than any other. TopTradersUnplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book called The Many Flavors of Trend Following, explaining exactly how these systematic strategies can work for you. Just go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's toptradersunplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Well, Eric's interview with Jeff Snyder and Luke Roman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now are Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder and Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman. As Macro Voices addicts already know, Luke and Jeff have both been outspoken in their Macro Voices All-Stars appearances about a global U.S. dollar liquidity shortage. But while Jeff and Luke clearly agree that there's a problem, they see that problem differently, sometimes leaving our listeners struggling to understand precisely where they agree and where they disagree. Both Jeff and Luke told me off the air that they both respect one another's views, and neither one of them wanted to be part of any sort of debate intended to prove the other guy wrong. And I applaud both of them for their professionalism in that regard. But since so many of you have asked for clarity on where Jeff and Luke agree and where they disagree, they've agreed to talk through their views in today's feature interview. So let's jump right in. Luke and Jeff, you've both spoken in the past about a U.S. dollar global liquidity problem. Please help our listeners understand how each one of you understands this problem. What exactly is the problem? Why is it so important? What caused it? And what adverse effects are being caused by it? Jeff, why don't we start with you?
Okay, well, you know, Eric and Luke, I think the best place to start is by reviewing why I use the term euro dollar specifically rather than just say global dollar. I mean, the word itself is far more meaningful than it might otherwise appear. I mean, there's a whole lot that's packed into, especially those four letters tacked on what should be straightforward national currency, a dollar, right? even today, if you go looking for a mainstream definition of a euro dollar, you'll get something that says, you know, it's a deposit of US dollars overseas. Now, while that's technically true, it's a very small subset because that's what the euro dollar was more of way back when it first popped up six decades ago. So you already see that, you know, conventions when we're talking about the euro dollar, they're already extremely outdated. So while it started out as deposits of US dollars overseas in the 60s and 70s, it became a whole lot more than those. That's why when, you know, former Treasury Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs, Robert Roussa, had attended the 40th anniversary of Bretton Woods in 1984, he said these euro dollars were what he called new networks of interbank relations that made possible the creation of additional supplies of dollars outside the United States and beyond the control of the Federal Reserve. And a few years before that, in 1979, the former head of the Bank of Italy, Guido Carli, had said practically the same thing. It was a presence of an international banking system that multiplies U.S. liquid liabilities outside the control of any monetary authority. So you have to understand that, you know, what these two were talking about was essentially two very big conceptual and functional leaps. The first was that these were new networks of interbank relations, or this new international banking system that was multiplying U.S. liquid liabilities. It was a bank-centered global system which had evolved into its own way of doing things, these monetary things. And it had pioneered all sorts of innovative and creative ways of doing monetary things, which revolved around these interbank relationships. So long before the end of the 1970s, this Eurodollar system had invented its own monetary language, if you will. Now, the second crucial distinction is where this has all been taking place. Now, Roussa said outside the control of the Federal Reserve, while Carli said it was outside the control of any monetary authority. That's what offshore means. The Eurodollar means offshore, not just overseas. It is a shadow money system that has existed in the vast expanses of these black spaces all throughout the world. So the term Eurodollar means these two very important things, an offshore system that had long ago developed its own very different way of doing things, its own language. It's a meaningful distinction from merely saying global dollar. Now, what the Fed and other monetary authorities around the world had done was they realized how they didn't speak the language. They weren't at all fluent in Eurodollar. In fact, you know, officials would occasionally admit they barely recognized any of it. So what they decided that they were going to do was the central banks would take a detached, higher-level approach to money. Instead of worrying about the details of these, you know, unintelligible offshore interbank networks, the Fed would move around a single money rate, the federal funds rate. You know, the interest rate targeting was an expectations-based policy, not a money-based policy. And it was Alan Greenspan's Fed who, in particular, you know, he kept saying, you know, since we don't speak the language of the Eurodollar system, we'll just move the federal funds rate around and we just expect that the system will translate those inputs as necessary. We don't need to get into any of these monetary details. The banking system will do that for us and it will take care of them in order for, you know, the monetary system to behave in the way that we want it to. So even, you know, several key points during the 1990s, Alan Greenspan very publicly worried that, you know, something might be missing from all of this, you know, that Robert Roussa and Guido Carli and many others may have had a point. You know, in 1996, during Greenspan's infamous irrational exuberant speech, he wasn't really talking about the stock market. What he said was, before we even get to irrational exuberance, money supply trends had veered off past several years ago. And therefore, how would we even know if it was being rational or irrational? We don't speak the monetary language anymore. And since it is offshore, we have no real monetary frame of reference. So in a nutshell, that's all 2008 really was. Subprime mortgages were such a small part of it, maybe only just the catalyst that kicked things off. You know, it got the system thinking about all of these lingering doubts and that doubts that increasingly had no answers from authorities or anyone. So in other words, to sum it up, you had this detached bank-centered global money system spring up organically all on its own, independent of monetary authorities. And then when things started to go sideways in 2007 and 2008, those same authorities tried to come to its rescue, but found out, number one, they didn't speak its language. And number two, because it was offshore, they had no direct means to plug into it.
Okay, Jeff, you are framing the present day U.S. dollar liquidity squeeze that exists internationally in terms of something you've been studying for a very long time, and as I understand it, you've described in Eurodollar University, the series that we did with you a couple of years ago, this long story about the Eurodollar system, and you're describing the present event, which is a global U.S. dollar liquidity shortage, as being another symptom of this breakdown of the Eurodollar system that began in 2007. Now, I want to go to Luke and find out, Luke, are we even talking about the same problem? Do you think that the global liquidity shortage of U.S. dollars that you and Jeff and a whole bunch of other people have observed, do you think it fits the description that Jeff put it in, or are you talking maybe about a different U.S. dollar liquidity squeeze?
No, I think he did a good job of framing it up. I mean, I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is sort of, as a good friend of mine says, you have red dollars and you have green dollars, and the green dollars are the onshore dollars, and that's what the Fed has governance over, and the red dollars are the offshore dollars, and the Fed has no governance over that. The Fed can only create base money for, and they have typically managed to the green dollars, and the issue is that the ratio of red dollars to green dollars over the past 50 years has just gone into the stratosphere. And so what started originally as a regulatory arbitrage sometime in either the late 60s or 70s took on a life of its own. And so now you have this system that can create dollar liabilities, but cannot create dollar-based money to cover those liabilities. And it can all work just fine as long as the Fed can move rates from, you know, 15% in the early 80s on their way all the way down the curve over 30 years down to zero. But once you get to zero, you have a problem. And it leads you to one of two conclusions once you get to that point. And you know, the two outcomes or the two solutions once you get to that point is either the whole system basically defaults on those on the euro dollar system, the system breaks down. And of course, you know, the challenge within that is that the euro dollar system is effectively infinitely leveraged. There's no reserves, as we just noted. And so when you go back to 08, you know, the two big to fail banks that got into trouble were levered 60x and, you know, 40x, 50x, 60x. And people that are negative on China these days say, well, China's leveraged 50x or 100x or 200x. And like, that's child's play compared to the euro dollar system because it's infinitely leveraged. So once you get rates to zero, then the supply, the Fed's ability to manage the onshore dollar, offshore dollar relationship becomes impaired. And so once you get to that point, one of two things happen. Either you basically have to default on the euro dollar system, or basically the whole system implodes, or the Fed has to start creating base money in extraordinarily large amounts. And so I think ultimately, I think we're seeing this dollar liquidity problem vis-a-vis the euro dollar system in a pretty similar manner.
Yeah, Luke, in my understanding and the way I see this, interest rates are an independent part of this. I don't think interest rates are any constraint on euro-dollar liquidity or euro-dollar leverage or however you describe it. And one of the reasons I think that way is because that the euro-dollar system is not a store of value. It's not like that, you know, this is credit creation for the sake of storing money and doing all the things that go along with that monetary function. It's historically been essentially strictly a medium of exchange. And so the level of interest rates, I don't want to say it's immaterial because that's probably way too far, but the way the interest rates actually factor in the euro dollar system, it almost doesn't matter, because what does matter are all of these other things that banks do. Like when you pointed out that Lehman Brothers was leveraged, what, 60 times? Bear Stearns was leveraged 60 times. It's the way that banks construct their balance sheet. Because this is a bank-centered system, what matters to it is not interest rates. What matters to it is how banks can efficiently manage their liability and asset structure. And so that's how I see, you know, what is a global dollar problem since 2008 is the fact that banks can't manage their balance sheets in the way that they used to. And that has very little to do with what the Federal Reserve does.
I don't disagree with that. When I think about the interest rate side of it, it's more just, to your point, you know, the expectations management, the liquidity increase you get from the expectations management which is once you get to zero, everybody knows, okay, now what? They can't cut.
Oh, you said you're from the Fed's perspective, right? Yeah, the Fed's out of ammunition.
They're out of ammunition. And I think which changes.
They got nothing left.
Yeah, it changes the liquidity perspective in terms of how you're going to manage those liabilities, in terms of all that, because everybody knows the system's infinitely leveraged, and you kind of go, okay, you know, it's sort of a moment akin to what you had in, call it 06, 07 or whatever, right? Where sort of everybody knew everybody else and themselves were all doing all of these crazy things in subprime and with subprime derivatives. And nobody wanted to do anything because they all sort of knew everybody, everybody was in the same boat. And I think there's something akin to it here where you kind of go, okay, well, everybody knows the euro dollar system's infinitely levered. And that means either the system's really going to come unhinged or they need to create epic amounts of liquidity. And I think, on some level, you can see that in the behavior of markets since 2008, right? Where it's either feast or famine. Either, okay, they're going to supply some more liquidity to keep this thing going. Okay, own risk or don't own risk. It's just been, sort of very binary.
Right. And I think, you get back to, it's a big point. And I think maybe the biggest point here is, what does the Fed do now? They've run out of ammunition. Interest rates are already low. ECB, what are they going to, they never even got off of zero, never even got off of negative rates. But where I'm coming from is the market knows that. And it knows that no matter what the Fed does, it doesn't matter because it's already proven that they don't speak the language. The Fed doesn't understand the system. They don't speak the right language. And even if they did speak the right language, what could they do? Because, again, I like the way you put it, red dollars and green dollars. The Fed has no statutory authority in the red dollar. In fact, nobody has authority in the red dollars, which is exactly what, Guido Carli and Robert Russo were talking about 35 years ago. What happens when we have this organically grown offshore system? What happens if it starts to go awry? And what I'm talking about, Eric, what we had talking about a lot is 2008 was not a one-off event. It was a systemic break. So the system has been in some form of decay ever since that point. And over time, we see these increasing responses from central banks that outside of sentiment have very, very little or no monetary effects on that system. And I think that's incorporated into what you're seeing in market prices now, which is everybody knows the Fed is going to do something. Everybody knows next week or this week, the ECB is probably going to do more QE. It's probably going to do more negative rates. And still you see the market say, it doesn't matter. The Fed doesn't speak the right language. The ECB doesn't speak the right language. And there's very little they can do about it as the system is currently construed.
I agree. And I think the key phrase to that is as the system is currently construed, which is then you start to take a look around and see what some of these policymakers are beginning to discuss, whether it's, Mark Carney 2 weeks ago saying, the dollar's the problem. We need to change this system away from dollar as purely the reserve asset. If you look at even in today in the Financial Times, it was a real woe moment for me. But I don't know if you saw that Euroclear is talking about setting up a system that will allow Chinese sovereign debt to be accepted as collateral for repo transactions anywhere in the world. And when you take a look at what central banks have been doing all along with gold, particularly in the European side in the last 3 weeks, where they for the first time in 20 years, decided to not renew the central bank agreement on gold. All by way of saying is that your point that as the system is currently constructed is the governor on this thing, is the limiting factor on generating liquidity. And so if you take a look and around sort of on the fringes or sort of watch what is being done rather than what's being said, to me, it seems very clear in a number of different markets. And of course, a big thrust of what we've been talking about, which is multi-currency pricing on energy and other commodities all move the system towards being restructured because to your point, as the system's structured, your options are collapse or the Fed monetizes it all permanently.
I'm going to jump in here and summarize what I've heard so far and ask you both to confirm whether I've got it right. Clearly, we're talking about an international phenomenon. This is not about something happening inside the United States. The issue, as Luke put it, is we've got red dollars and green dollars. The green dollars are in the United States. The red dollars are the U.S. dollars that are outside the United States. And to summarize what I've heard, in the past, going back a few decades, even though the Federal Reserve wasn't doing anything at all to service the liquidity requirements for those red dollars, those liquidity requirements for the red dollars were getting serviced through free enterprise. For whatever reason, we had motivations in the balance of economics that allowed the commercial banking system to create all of the U.S. dollar liquidity that the world needed by creating U.S. dollar denominated loans outside of the U.S. banking system. And that worked for a while. The thing is, the private sector does things when there's a profit to be made, and it's government that steps in to do things when there's no profit and liquidity is needed. The Fed has always been organized to meet domestic liquidity requirements. And when we now have suddenly an international U.S. dollar liquidity requirement that's not being addressed by the commercial banking system and the private sector, there's nobody to step up to the plate and to deal with the problem. Is that essentially what we're talking about here?
I think that's fair. I think you've just reached this point where you can't. I think that's fair.
Yeah, and Eric, it's tough to summarize the stuff as Luke and I both know very well, and you know very well. There's a lot more complexities to all of these things, but you know, to put it in a nutshell, yeah, that's pretty much what we're talking about here.
Okay, so now that we understand what the dollar problem is, which is that there is international demand for red dollars, dollars outside the U.S. banking system, that demand was satisfied by the commercial eurodollar system historically. Nobody has an obligation to satisfy that need. Suddenly, the commercial eurodollar system is not solving the problem. What I want to talk about next is you guys, in the course of a few minutes, have explained that very succinctly. So you understand it. I understand it. Now our listeners understand it. My question is, how well does the Federal Reserve and the other central bankers around the world understand this problem? Do they understand that right now we have a crisis being created by an insufficiency of red dollars in the global economy, and that there is no governmental organization, the Fed or any other, who's chartered with satisfying that need, and that it's causing problems? Do they get it? Do they understand it? Do they know that something has to be done? Or are they not paying attention because it's not their job? And let's face it, it's not their job.
It depends on which central bankers you're talking about, Eric. I think, you know, Upton Sinclair famously said it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary is dependent upon his not understanding it. So when I take a look back, right, the system broke, as Jeff noted, in 2008. By March of 2009, the head of the PBOC, Zhao, said, he told us what the fix is, said the world needs to move to a neutral settlement asset to help create new liquidity and basically break this dollar problem. And it was an interesting piece put out there. The IMF said something similar in 2011. But the point of it, to tie that back to my point, is that I think some central bankers get it and some don't, or don't want to, is that we can see, obviously, the system has not changed in the ensuing 10 years in the manner in which the PBOC wanted it to change. And so what you've seen is China go about arbitraging the fact that the system did not change in the manner in which it needed to be changed. And by that, I mean, PBOC comes out and says, we need to move to a neutral settlement asset. Basically, we need to create a new source of repo collateral liquidity, as I suspect Jeff would refer to it as in terms of the parlance. And the world said no. And so China said, okay, we're going to borrow all the dollars we can possibly borrow, and we'll buy anything but dollars. We will buy, you know, finite ports, gold, oil fields, copper mines, stocks, anything that is basically, and we'll just keep doing this because they understand that the system is broken. They have to understand. You can see it in their actions. If 2008, the outcome was either restructure the system or the system will collapse, and they don't restructure the system in 2009 as the PBOC advocated, then the optimal strategy is borrow as many dollars as you can, as long as you don't have to market to market, and just keep buying assets until, you know, basically what it would amount to is the dollar is forced to be marked to market. And so I think the PBOC gets it. I think on some level, Western central bankers get it. I think the issue is less do they get it or not. I think more the issue are the political ramifications on a couple of fronts. And just, and when I say political, I just mean we're talking about structure of the dollar's reserve currency status and the way the system has worked since 1971, which confers a lot of power in Washington. And so this isn't just a pure case of, hey, do the central bankers get it or not? I think it's, do the central bankers get it, and are they allowed to get it by the people in Washington? Because these are geopolitical issues, not simply economic.
Yeah, Luke, you're exactly right about that point. And it's been this way since, you know, Bretton Woods, even long before then. I mean, global reserve currency is a political hot topic, and it always will be. And there's always going to be resistance to even discussing the point, whether it's the U.S. officials or not. They're not going to want to say, hey, we're going to do something about the dollar, because the dollar everybody perceives of as a national interest rather than an international interest. But where I think I would disagree with you is on China. I mean, first of all, I don't see the Chinese officials acting particularly long-sighted. I see them very much reactive, because they have the world's biggest dollar problem. You're right. They have the world's biggest dollar problem. And so what they've been doing over the last 5 years in particular is they've been hit with the worst end of the dollar shortage and the dollar squeeze. And that has forced them into all sorts of bad consequences, including, as Eric and I talked about a few weeks ago, an internal monetary problem, because that's how this dollar system is set up. Not only do we have to worry about the red dollars, but the red dollars actually have impacts in these local systems, especially China. The Chinese monetary system, RMB, is dollarized. So every dollar, every red dollar that the Chinese don't have, that's RMB that the PBOC cannot create. And so what you've seen over the last 5 years is a monetary squeeze inside of China as well as outside of China. And because of that, they've had all sorts of bad ramifications from it. And so the larger issue to me is, what are they waiting for? If they know that this is a problem and they see that there's a solution to it, or they think that they could possibly get some kind of something on the book, some kind of alternative, to even get the world thinking about an alternative. I mean, we're talking about 5 and 6 years. 2013 was when all of these symptoms started showing up and the CNY reversed in early 2014. So if they could have done something, they would have long before now, especially now with Chinese economic system becoming a total mess. In fact, you know, we have no idea how bad it is inside of China right now. And again, it all traces back to the fact that the PBOC has a dollar problem. And you're right, they have a dollar problem. But whether they know enough about it, or whether they have the ability to understand exactly what's going on so that we're going to do something about it, or whether they can even think about doing something about it, I think those are very much open questions. And especially recently, last couple of years, I see more of a central bank in panic mode than anything else.
I don't disagree. I think you're exactly right that they have been managing out of panic mode over the last 5 years. I disagree that they haven't been acting. And what I think they've been working to do, this then ties back to our point in the energy markets, right, with this yuan oil contract, which launched in early March or March of 2018, was widely expected to be a flop, has not been a flop, is now rivaling in front and second month volumes the Brent contract in terms of open interest. But the point is this, is China has a dollar problem. And if you look at China's current account, China's non-commodity goods trade surplus is about $700 billion to the good, right? So it's a surplus, 700. So the point, another way of saying that is that if China can price its energy and commodity imports in yuan that it can print, then China will be able to create out of thin air $700 billion per year, dollars, which will end their dollar problem basically forever until our kids have kids have kids. And so when I agree with you that they have been scrambling and that has gone live in 2013, I disagree that they're not doing something about it. And ultimately, I think what we're seeing is the change in the monetary system is being forced through commodity and energy markets.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't think that the PBOC has been doing nothing. They haven't been sitting on their hands. It's not in their nature to sit on their hands. But what I'm saying is what they have done is ineffective because, look, global currency, global reserve currency means something. It doesn't just mean that we're going to reprice something in our own currency. There has to be depth. There has to be liquidity. You know, Robert Solomon's three pillars of a global reserve. There has to be liquidity. There has to be adjustment functions. And there has to be confidence. And CNY, Chinese yuan, does not meet those thresholds. In fact, the internal monetary problem in RMB prevents them from using yuan as a global settlement currency because there isn't enough of it. There has to be enough of this currency. That's the whole point. That's the whole reason the euro dollar took over was because it had solved what Robert Triffin called a paradox, which was a national currency supplying enough of itself into the international system that, you know, beyond its own means. And so the euro dollar had created, in essence, the ability to solve Triffin's paradox. And, you know, there's no way in my mind.
Well, temporarily,
we're,
right?
We're trying to. Obvious. Well, yeah, well, temporarily. It lasted for a few decades.
Yeah, he wasn't talking about it, but yeah, it's later, right? But
that was the euro dollar's best attributes was the fact that it could all the liquidity for a while up until 2007, all the liquidity the globalizing world would ever need in U.S. dollars, which also solved the confidence issue. And by the way, it was also so flexible. It could reinvent itself over time. That was the adjustment function. You know, the way that the international eurodollar system works today is nothing like what it did in, you know, again, going back to it was offshore deposits of U.S. dollars. Now it's a bunch of FX and interbank derivatives. So, you know, CNY doesn't meet those aspects. So I'm going to disagree with you and say that what can the Chinese do about in terms of their global reserve currency? They still have a dollar problem.
Hang on a second, guys, because what we're talking about here is how we resolve this problem that the U.S. dollar is the world's global reserve currency, and it needs to supply enough of itself, as Jeff said, in order to satisfy global needs. That used to be satisfied through the euro dollar system. It's not working anymore. The Fed's not stepping up. Now, it seems to me that we can't ignore something like Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, going to Jackson Hole a couple of weeks ago, the Fed's big event of the season, monetary conference, and saying, guys, we need to consider a multipolar, as he put it. Now, I see the word multipolar as a central banker euphemism for we need to ditch the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency and replace it with something where we don't have one country in charge of the global reserve currency anymore. And he's proposing a digital currency, as I predicted in my book, oh, by the way, that would potentially do that. So it seems to me like the game is changing really, really quickly. It used to be unthinkable for anyone to suggest the U.S. dollar was not going to be the world's global reserve currency forever. And we got the head of the Bank of England at Jackson Hole, the Fed's own turf, saying, guys, we need to think about a multipolar solution here. To me, that's a really big upset. Do you not see it that way?
No, I think Luke's point earlier, you know, the governor of the PBOC, Zhao, said the same thing back in 2000. That was 10 years ago. I think things are moving incredibly slowly, not quickly. You know, Luke, you mentioned how the central bankers have seen the dollar problem. Well, yeah, it took them 12 years to realize that when the dollar rises in exchange value, that's a bad thing. It took them 12 years to figure out what was the easiest correlation in the world to establish. So I don't see them moving at a quick pace. I see them moving glacially, which is, I mean, look, let's face it, that's what central banks are. They're bureaucracies. There's a ton of institutional inertia associated with these things. I think what Luke is talking about is more likely the situation that if the eurodollar system breaks, then it's like, oh, crap, what do we do now? Now we actually have to do something. But I think the way that the world is moving now, absent, say, another 2008, incredibly slowly at a glacial pace where it's like we only admit something when it's completely obvious and it happens four times.
I don't disagree. I think they've known it for a long time. I think there's when do you know something and when are you allowed to admit it?
And, yeah, and I think that's a key question, right? I mean,
I think they knew it 12 years ago, right? Otherwise, Bernanke wouldn't have written all those checks to the European banks, right? The fact is, you know, you don't write what? How many trillions to banks and not know the reason you're writing the checks? I mean, he was awfully sheepish in his congressional testimony about why he wrote those checks, who he wrote them to. And I have a hard time believing somebody writes trillions of dollars in checks or prints trillions of dollars in money and hands them over to foreign banks, knowing you're going to have to testify without understanding it. So I think it's more they know what they're allowed to say. But I think, you know.
We've got a recent example, Luke, the IMF in Argentina. The IMF, you know, June of 2018, Argentina was begging for some kind of aid because they have a dollar problem. And the IMF said, hey, we're going to come in and fix this for you. We've got the largest bailout in the institution's history. We're going to calm every market. The peso's going to be rescued because we know what the hell we're doing. And it blew up in their face in a matter of months. By August of 2018, Argentina was back to the IMF begging them for more. Hey, speed up those tranches. And oh, by the way, give us $7 billion more. And the IMF came in and said, you know what? We're going to do it. We're going to do it our way too. We're going to rewrite your monetary system. We're going to put the peso in a non-intervention zone. We did all sorts of these creative things. And it didn't work. What I'm saying is, you know, it goes back to my original point. These people don't speak the right language. I don't think they really understand all of the nuances, all the complexities, all of the details behind what's going on in the dollar system. And it shows. And oh, by the way, what happened to Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF? She gets bumped upstairs to the European Central Bank. And don't think that markets haven't noticed that.
Well, right. Well, think about this. Well, hold on. Think about this. Where did Argentina run into problems? It's with their imports, right? They're importing more than they're exporting, and they have a dollar problem. They don't have enough dollars, right? I mean, at the end of the day. And that's when I tie back the original point of who gets it, who doesn't. The PBOC, you look at what's going on with Chinese oil imports, they're paying it. Can they run out of yuan? The answer is no, they can't. They can print it. And when you say, well, it's not being accepted, I would say two things to that. Number one, if you look at IMF FX reserve balances over the last 12 months, US dollar balances have risen about 200 billion globally. And renminbi balances have risen 70 billion globally. So renminbi's FX reserve balances have risen in total about 35% as much as dollar balances have. But I think the broader or more important point is you have to understand that China doesn't want to run the dollar system. The dollar system required us to hollow out our manufacturing base, send it first to Mexico, then send it to China. And that's become a strategic weakness for the United States that China's not even going to start on. And so what China is really—
I just want to say, I agree with you there. The Chinese don't want this. It's a burden. It's not a privilege. I think that's a point that you're very right to make.
100%, right? So if it's a burden and not a privilege—
That's a huge burden.
Then you have to set a neutral asset up. And that's where, if you look at what China's doing, you know, they're a creditor, right? So if you're holding renminbi, and I have this discussion with people all the time, well, no one's going to take the renminbi. Well, no kidding, they're not going to take and hold the renminbi. What they're going to do is hold the renminbi. Number one, who runs a surplus against China? And the answer is virtually no one, right? So there's not going to be a lot of renminbi outstanding, to your point about the liquidity. But that's not a flaw. That's a design. That's the feature. And so if you do end up with renminbi, you can do a couple things with it. You can buy Chinese goods, which, you know, 10, 15 years ago were sort of, you know, cheap plastic trinkets at Walmart. Nobody wants that. But now, hey, would you like a completely, you know, state-of-the-art 5G system from Huawei? Yeah, sure. I'll take that with my renminbi. And oh, you still have some left over? How about some gold? Okay, but you can't take our gold. You can take gold out of London. You can take gold from the US, but you can't take gold that's in mainland China. And in doing this, this is over time going to bid the price of gold up. And as the price of gold goes up, it ends the dollar shortage. So like, they've thought about this. The system is there. The function of how fast it gets fixed is how basically on how fast the price of gold rises.
Okay, I think we've established now that central bankers probably do understand more than they are at liberty to admit, but still their institutions and the nature of government bureaucracy causes them to be able to respond at a pace slower than we would be used to in the private sector. So I want to shift gears now and discuss a hypothetical scenario. Please assume, for the sake of this discussion, that the central bankers do understand these issues every bit as well as you guys do. Hypothetically, and I don't think that's really true, but hypothetically, let's pretend that that were the case. With the assumption that they fully understand the problem, can it be solved, or could it be solved through policy action? Is there something that could be done here that would allow this dollar liquidity shortage to be solved? Or are we really in a situation where this is the impetus maybe that's going to take us to people responding as Mark Carney has begun to respond and say, hey, we need to find a different system because the U.S. dollar at the center of the global financial system is not working anymore?
I think Mark Carney's laying out the fix. I think that's the only fix there is you have to separate the store of value or the you know, the repo collateral, however you want to call it. The reserve asset has to be neutral. And this is what we heard from Charles de Gaulle in 1965. This is what we heard from Jel Zylstra in 1974. This is what we heard from, you know, the euro when they put 15% of reserves into gold, marked to market quarterly in 1999. This is what we heard from Zhao in 2009. And now this is what we hear finally from the Bank of England in 2019. And
well,
so,
didn't we hear it from John Maynard Keynes in 44?
We heard it from 44. And we have the Chinese moving the world towards a Bancor system by virtue of what's happened, what they're doing in the energy markets. If you look at what China's doing with the Yuan oil contract, they are basically forcing the world by using their clout in global energy and commodity markets, forcing the world to the John Maynard Keynes Bancor solution in 1944, where you have a neutral reserve asset that floats in all currencies and basically is at a different price in each currency based on each currency's balance of payments. And it's we're moving in that direction. To Jeff's point, will it get there fast enough? I don't know. And I think part of that is, again, it's a political question, right? Because this is not, hey, the central bankers get together and agree. This is, you know, the central bankers get together in Basel and agree. And then they call up the United States and the United States Marine Corps and say, hey, here's what we're going to do. And you guys are going to have to figure out how to finance yourselves going forward. And they say, yeah, about that, no. Or at least no until certain conditions are met. And I think it's that latter where it's no, not until certain conditions are met. And so when Jeff says it's taken us 12 years, well, I think those conditions, you know, number one, energy security. The United States would never allow this to happen unless it was self-sufficient in oil. In 2008, the United States produced about 6 to 8 million barrels a day and imported 10 to 12. Take a look at us now. We've got shale. Okay, check one. We've got that part done. I think part two is you got to really figure out a way to start getting U.S. manufacturing back here. We're talking about that now, you know, to Jeff's point. It takes a while, but I think that, you know, Carney's telling us the solution.
No, I have to disagree because, you know, again, I have a big problem, Eric, when you say we're going to assume that authorities know what they're talking about, because that's the big sticking point. How do you go from A to B? That's what we're really talking about. We all agree there needs to be a B. We all agree there needs to be a system beyond the Eurodollar system that actually functions. The question is, how do you get there? And if the authorities don't really understand what A is, they're not going to be able to get to B. And so that's my point. My point is, if you don't understand A, you can't get to B. And I include the Chinese in that because, you know, it's not just a merchandise. It's not just a function of everyone's merchandise value. That's not what the dollar is used for. In fact, much more than that is investment flows, or what people call hot money. Yuan is not going to be able to replace the dollar in terms of that financial function, which is a necessary function, part of a globalized economy. And so if you don't understand A, how do you get to B? But, you know, let's assume they do understand A. How do you go from A to B? And, you know, it's good that people are thinking about what B might look like, but you still have to get from one to the other. How do you revalue trillions and trillions of contracts that are not on anyone's books? How do you revalue everything that doesn't just blow up the system? How, maybe going from A to B is worse than sticking with A, which, by the way, I would argue is one of the reasons why A has persisted as long as it has, is because that there is so much difficulty, there's so much complexity. It's like a Gordian knot. How do you untangle this mess and straighten it out enough that you can design a system that goes from A to B? And so my big contention is, how do we get to B? Before we even think about B, how do you get out of A?
Well, it sounds like Luke is saying that what the B really is that the U.S. dollar's status as global reserve currency has come seriously under question and is very much at imminent risk of changing. Now, I don't think that anybody in the U.S. government, including the Fed, sees it that way. I'm not saying that it's not perhaps true, but I don't think the U.S. government believes that the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the global financial system is at risk of ending. Is that what you think, Luke? And Jeff, what do you think?
You know, I think if you ask the people at the Fed, they would agree with you. I think if you ask the guys at the Department of Defense, they would have an entirely different opinion because they now see it's a matter of national security, basically, that it does end as structured and move to something more akin to pre-1971 and probably something more like, you know, possibly like Keynes's Bancor, right? Because, you know, there was a great report last fall put out, you know, the unclassified version laying out that basically significant portions of the United States' defense supply chain is either sole sourced or no sourced, no sourced domestically or sole sourced domestically, and in some cases, sole sourced through China, which is a suboptimal arrangement. And that's a function of the deindustrialization that has had to take place by virtue of the constraints of this Eurodollar system since 1971. You know, I think in terms of going from A to B, to Jeff's point, you know, I think there's the, if you look at what these Basel III regulations or reforms have done, as somebody, you know, one of my best relationships on the street noted, in short, that basically Basel III constrains the size and elasticity of matched repo books, right? So to the extent that that's happening, that's, you know, the dollar shortage we're feeling is by design. Now, the question is okay, are they doing this to kick off the crisis you need to fix the problem? Or are they, you know, why are they doing this? And under, you know,
Can I jump in here for a second? Just,
Go ahead, absolutely.
Basel III was, all it did was codify what the banking system had already been doing since 2007. Basel III had no impact on the way banks construct their balance sheet and the constraints that they're feeling. The behaviors that banks undertook in 2008 was what Basel III eventually did, you know, years later. So the fact that, you know, the regulators caught up to something that had already happened years ago, for, you know, again, it's to my point that I don't think they really understand what's going on. They're just doing things in the dark because they don't know what else to do. And so it gets back to the point, if you don't understand A, how do you get to B? And I think that's the big question is, before we ever design B, we need to understand A. You know, how do you untangle this? This is not 1944 anymore. It's not as simple as John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter White getting together in New Hampshire and saying, oh, we'll create this other Bancor type of global reserve currency. How does that work in the modern environment where everything is traded at a microsecond and in massive size? You know, these are questions that I don't believe anybody has seriously contemplated. And for one reason is because they don't really understand the nature of it. A lot of the stuff that takes place, you know, when I talk about shadow money, I mean literally shadow money. There is money that exists out there that nobody knows about. We BIS doesn't know about it. I mean, when the BIS took a look at the Eurodollar system a couple of years ago, I think it was 2017, in one of their quarterly reviews, they said, you know what, we went looking in the footnotes of all of these banks and we found tens of trillions of dollars in functional FX derivatives that function as debt and currency that it doesn't appear on any tape anywhere. So we don't even know how big of a problem we have.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because those, I remember that report. And if you look at what it was, $13 or $14 trillion in derivatives they found, what the functional effect of that was to allow the U.S. government to borrow more money than they otherwise would have, you know, to basically circumvent balance
sheet. The U.S. government is only have a privileged position because of the original sin, which was all sovereign debt would be given a zero risk weighting and that the repo market accepts sovereign debt as a lowest haircut option. So the intent was not to give the U.S. government borrowing privileges. It's been piggybacking on those privileges.
It's been piggybacking. And it's interesting, right? Because as soon as, if you go to the last fall, you know, back in September of last year, regulators began telling banks, hey, stop growing your FX swap books. And that was when you started to see FX hedge treasury yields go wildly negative, as basically once banks' FX swap books were unable to keep growing forever and ever and ever, to your point.
Yeah, but they've been shrinking since 2008. It wasn't like they've been growing exponentially. No. FX books have been shrinking for the last 12 years, which is part of the problem. What we're talking about here is the efficiency of banks to be able to construct their balance sheet. Derivatives are a huge part of that, both as far as regulatory capital oversight, risk oversight, as well as liquidity, because FX functions as liquidity. What the BIS report was talking about in 2017 was these trillions of dollars in FX are a liquidity function. Yeah, the U.S. government was piggy banking about it.
Yeah,
but it's
the U.S. government.
But that's not the intent here. The intent is to provide liquidity. If there is lack of liquidity in FX, what do we do about it? And again, it gets to the point, how do we get from A to B? If how do you solve that issue?
You raise a critically important issue. If it was ultimately the U.S. government borrowing and now these things are unwinding, who's getting cut off? And you can see this manifest, and the answer is the U.S. government.
Well, no, because it makes the treasuries more valuable because of the liquidity.
But it's
liquidity
a short-term, absolutely. 100% it does. But it also is, and this is, you know, how do you choke out the global minotaur? And the answer is you do it very carefully and you make it look like it's everybody at once. You don't try to do it all by yourself and you do it by regulation. So what you're watching is basically global regulations post 2008 that are forcing the United States to finance their own deficits for the first time in 70 years. And like you said, the initial impact of that is that, yeah, treasury yields go down a bunch and the dollar goes up a bunch. And obviously we've seen that since 3Q14 when global central banks stopped sterilizing U.S. deficits. And so what we've been seeing
is a dollar shortage.
It creates a dollar shortage until it doesn't. And that's what we've been writing about, which is this crowding out effect where, the global regulatory regime post 08 has been effectively designed to force the United States to finance its own deficits, which isn't because we don't run these deficits because we're bad or because we're profligate per se. It's because this is how the system worked. We had to run the deficits under that old world. And so if the world is changing, the first way you stop that world from changing or within the course of that world changing, the U.S. has to stop having the rest of the world finance its own deficits or finance its deficits for it. And so, to your point of where are we on this and how do you go from A to B, I think we're in the process of going from A to B. And the way that starts is you start regulating the United States to start financing its own deficits for the first time in 70 years. And Jeff, to your point, post 08, that began happening. Then
if you look at the market prices of all of these dollar events, they don't line up to regulatory changes. In fact, the regulatory changes play very little part in what's happening. It's the banking system, this bank-centered system reacting on its own.
100%. It is reacting on its own, but it's basically the market. Once you regulate it, and then once global central banks stop sterilizing U.S. deficits, that's all you have to do. This is like the subprime avalanche. This is akin to when the banks stopped writing subprime insurance, by basically stopped writing CDS and turned buyers. The markets took care of the rest, right? The whole facade came unraveled. This is something similar here, where all you have to do is put the regulations in place, and then global central banks have to stop buying treasuries, which they did in 3Q14, and everything else will just take care of it. Now, what will that look like in the short run? Well, initially, you'll see the dollar rally tremendously, right? And so in 3Q14, we saw the Dixie go from 70 to 88 and call it 15 or 16 months. And then before it peaked at 103, a year and a half after that, you would see, just a relentless bid for treasuries for regulatory purposes. We're seeing that. And ultimately, where this would all continue to play out, you'd eventually see negative interest rates elsewhere as FX hedging costs for dollars got so expensive that actually, as an American, I can buy euro debt at a negative rate, hedge out the currency, and actually make a positive yield. And
yeah, so that's dollar shortage. Look,
100%.
The cross currency basis, the negative basis, is another form of the dollar shortage. And you go back to what central banks have done.
The end game is that the Fed has to print it all. Basically, the U.S. either has to go into austerity or the Fed has to monetize it. That's where this is all going.
Guys, I want to jump in here because so far we've been talking about things I think that we all agree on, which is there is for sure a global dollar liquidity squeeze. There's a shortage of dollars internationally, and it's causing all kinds of serious problems. Now, that, I think we can agree, at least brings some question to whether or not the U.S. dollar can continue to be the world's global reserve currency in the same capacity that it has been in for the last several decades. The place where I think it's really important for us to get to in this interview, because a lot of listeners have been trying to understand why you guys disagree so strongly on some things, yet you seem to agree so completely on so many others. Luke, you think that even though you've just described a whole bunch of reasons for this dollar squeeze pushing the dollar higher, you think that that's about to end. And I'm really struggling to understand why, because for all the reasons you yourself just described, I think what Jeff and I see coming is a continued U.S. dollar appreciation against other currencies, because although certainly the U.S. dollar's status as reserve currency may come into question, it is still in that role today. As long as it's still in that role, we're seeing a squeeze. We're seeing dollar push higher. Why would you expect dollar to move lower under these circumstances?
The answer is really simple, because the U.S. Defense Department wants it to. The U.S. Defense Department needs it to. There's nobody more short dollars than the United States, and the United States government specifically. And so I would reference you back to the point I made before about this Defense Department report from last either October or November. The United States' ability to fight wars is being impeded by the dollar at 98, by the dollar where it is. And so, if you're short dollars more than everybody else. And importantly, you know, you're having this rivalry with China that I don't think we need to go into. I don't think anyone would say that that's not happening. You can't have China sole sourcing manufactured goods. And ultimately, you got to bring some of this stuff back. And to do this, you have to have the dollar structure changed back to where you can make stuff here. And there's a number of different ways you can do that. But, you know, the bottom line is that whether you look at it from the Defense Department supply chain angle, or whether you look at it from the U.S. government tax receipt angle, you know, last time we were at 103 on the Dixie, you had tax receipts falling at a 3-5% annual rate. You know, when you have tax receipts falling at a 3-5% annual rate, and the debt, the interest coupon on your debt, which is 100 and almost 10% of GDP, growing at a, call it 2.2 or 2.3% rate, that's what's known in the parlance as a death spiral. And we have more leeway on that death spiral than everybody else. But at the end of the day, the way that gets resolved is they'll print the difference. And so whether we decide to do it proactively, unilaterally, or whether the dollar goes to 103 or 102 or whatever it is, you know, people say, oh, it'll go to 110, it'll go to 120. Look, tax receipts will be falling 10, 12, 15% a year with a, you know, 2.2% coupon to the positive. So every year we'll be falling 10 to 12% further into a death spiral. And this is not going to be allowed to happen for any real period of time. And so I think that when you say, despite all of these things which are dollar positive, which they 100% are, the political realities, the domestic political realities of national security, you know, look, Warren Buffett says for 240 years, it's not paid to bet against the Americans. I'm not betting against the Americans. I'm betting on the Americans, and the Americans need the dollar down.
I agree with you, Luke. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we both agree on, is that the situation is untenable. Where I think we disagree is in how. You know, the U.S. Defense Department may want the dollar devalued so that they can do all of the things that they need to do to fulfill their mandate. The question is, you know, the U.S. Treasury is not in charge of the dollar. The Federal Reserve is not in charge of the dollar. The dollar is set by a euro-dollar system that at the current moment preferences the dollar and the dollar-valued assets, especially U.S. Treasuries as repo collateral. And so, you know, it's not a matter of, okay, we see that there's a problem we need to do something about it, is what can you do about it? And there, again, I think they're very limited. Number one, I don't believe they understand the problem as it actually is, because it took them 12 years to figure out, hey, when the dollar goes up, that's a bad thing. And so, okay, now that you see that, what's all of the stuff behind it? You've got 60 years of banking and monetary evolution to catch up on. You know, maybe there's a few staff papers here and there that's been written by central bankers where, you know, every once in a while. But especially in the upper levels, there's a very clear lack of understanding of the situation. And I don't want to say they're a bunch of Pollyanna-ish, you know, rose-colored glasses type of people, but I don't think they really understand the nature of what they're facing. In fact, you know, that's why 2008 happened. That's why 2011 happened. That's why 2014 happened. And that's why we're doing it all over again. And so, you know, without being able to answer the question of how do you get the dollar to behave in the way that you want it to behave, it's essentially a moot issue.
Jeff, I want to ask one point of clarification. When you and I hold the view that this has to result in the dollar appreciating from here, I know you and I agree on that, where Luke says he thinks the dollar needs to go the other way, do you disagree with him, or would you agree with me in saying Luke is exactly right, but he's just early?
No, I think the key word in what you said is need. The dollar needs to go the other way. That I think I would agree with. The question is, can the dollar go the other way as the system is currently construed? And that's where I have all this problem. And I run into this a lot. People think I'm advocating for the system. I'm not. I'm trying to analyze the system as it actually is and understand that, you know, okay, our problem is system A, this red dollar versus green dollar system doesn't work, but there really is no functional, no effective, no realistic alternative to it. And so, you know, does the dollar need to change? Yes, absolutely. Are we close to the point where the dollar can change and something can take over for it? No, I don't think we're anywhere close to that, because, again, I don't believe officials have any idea what they're up against.
See, I think this all comes to a head someday, and then Luke gets proven right. So, like, Luke, I want to give you the last word here. Why would the dollar start to move down against other currencies before this all comes to a head and the world changes its mind about the dollar being reserve currency?
I think you just have to watch, you know, the tax receipts and the U.S.'s relative position from a national defense perspective. And when you say, economically speaking, I agree with you guys. Geopolitically speaking, I would love to be a fly on the wall the day when someone walks over to the Pentagon in Washington and says, hey, guys, you know, we need you to bring home about half of those bases and we can't develop your weapons because we don't have enough dollars. And, you know, I know that we're in this competition with China, but we're going to have to cut your R&D budget. And like that's going to be a really short, really one-sided conversation, probably at a pretty high volume on the part of the Defense Department guys. And so, you know, my point is that, yes, there's a dollar shortage. Nobody is more short dollars than the U.S. government. And as far as I know, there is no sovereign in history that has had a purely fiat currency and has willingly gone out of business for lack of fiat dollars or fiat currency. And you know, Greenspan and Richard Fisher and Larry Lindsey, former Fed governor, talked about this in 2015. And what Lindsey said is, listen, this is a matter of liberty. The state, the obligations of the state are no longer affordable. The problem is that the state will not let itself go out of business. It will push everybody else out of the way. It will get itself funded. And that's what we've seen since 2014. And that's what's driven the dollar higher. So it's driven rates lower. But at some point, the state is so big in terms of the credit markets, that even that's not enough. They can crowd out everybody else, and the money still has to then turn into helicopter money. And I just think we're a lot closer to that helicopter money moment than most people think. And I think some of the things we've seen recently, you know, BlackRock Institute with Stan Fisher and Jean Boivin and Philip Hildebrand paper last month, for example, talking about in the next crisis, we're going to go direct and just, you know, helicopter money and we'll pin yield, et cetera. I just think we're much closer to that moment. I think the data suggests that we're much closer to that moment than a lot of people think.
We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. I can't thank both of you enough for an absolutely outstanding interview, and we will continue to get both of your views heard in your upcoming All-Stars appearances. Listeners, be sure to send us any questions or follow-ons you want us to address with Luke and Jeff in those All-Stars appearances. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview. I was almost like an hour's not enough with that interview, but it was so good to hear them going at it. It was just high quality. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I think this is a really, really important topic, needless to say, but take a big step back. And this is something that Jeff and Luke and I agreed not even to get into the politics of it because we didn't really have time for the content we did cover. It was a challenge to get it into the time we had available. But if you take a step back and think about this whole situation, what Jeff and Luke are saying is there's this really complex, intricate problem where, as Luke put it, there's people in charge of the green dollars, but nobody's really in charge of the supply of red dollars. And there's a massive global shortage of red dollars, and it's causing all of these problems. Well, this is happening at a time when monetary policy itself is becoming extremely politicized. Just look at President Trump's rhetoric. I think he actually called the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee members boneheads this week in a tweet. We're getting to this very political environment. And so my prediction is not only will Jeff Snyder and Luke Grohman not be in charge of solving this problem, but I don't think that Mario Draghi and Jay Powell and Kuroda-san are going to have that much say either. I think we're coming into an environment where it's going to be Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the political stage where they will use modern monetary theory as the basis to argue for what is essentially governments monetizing a whole bunch of spending. Politicians have figured out that it's possible for the Fed to conjure money out of thin air, and they see it as a way to spend money without having to alienate voters by taxing them, and they want in on the deal. So we've got a really, really difficult problem that probably central bankers don't completely understand. So it's challenging enough, and it's coming at a time when the central bank's control over monetary policy is being threatened by the attempts of politicians to take over monetary policy. And, you know, whether or not Jeff Snyder is correct that, maybe Jay Powell and Mario Draghi don't fully understand this global dollar shortage problem, I'm not sure. But I'm really pretty confident Bernie Sanders doesn't understand this stuff. And those are the people that are going to have the most say as we get into an environment where monetary policy becomes politicized. So I think it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens in the next few years. And I think that politics are going to play a much bigger role in this whole process than they ever have in the past. But in any event, Patrick, I want to move on now to the commodity chart book you prepared for us, which we promised last week. Let's go ahead and dive into this chart book, starting on page 2. What do we got here?
Right. So what I wanted to do is just go through all of the different commodities. I didn't have a chance to put them all in, but I highlight some of the key ones that would be really fun to talk about with our for our listeners. The first one I wanted to just put up was that chart on crude oil. Now, I know that you cover that extensively in your Energy Weeks and all your interviews, but what I thought was fascinating was the fact that we continued to see, at least for most of 2019, an incredibly tight trade range for crude oil. And I'm dying to find out which way crude is going to go next here. Now, I certainly have a little bit of a bias that that this could break lower, but it certainly can go any direction here. I was curious, so what's your thinking in terms of where the next major move in crude could go?
Well, I also have a bias that I think eventually economic reality is going to set in and that we are going to be headed lower in crude oil prices, along with the prices of a lot of other things. But until this Bolton news came out, I was really amazed by the strength in the tape. It really looked like we were breaking. The next technical target I saw was about 61 or so. And then, of course, everything changed dramatically on this news about John Bolton. Is that news going to be enough to completely reverse the trend? We're seeing at least a little dead cat bounce this afternoon. Oftentimes, Friday is an up day for the crude oil market. Be interesting to see if we retrace and recover some of the losses of the last couple of days. I think that economically, I would look for lower prices. We just had IEA come out with an expectation of less demand. There was a report from Russia. I wonder why they would even publish this, saying that they should brace for the possibility of a return to $25 oil prices. Now, whether or not these things are actually going to happen or whether those reports are accurate, you know, these things hit the market and it affects sentiment, and oil is a very sentiment-driven market. So we've had a major stumble in the last few days. And I think it's a little bit early to tell, but I won't be surprised if this finally is what takes us to lower numbers. So far, though, the number to watch has really been $50. Every time we get down to 50, we've seen a very vigorous rebound and it's back up higher. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens next.
All right. Well, I wanted to move on to page 3, where I wanted to just quickly highlight some interesting observations on copper. Now, I know that a lot of technicians, including myself, were observing that break back in May of that 260 level where the lows were, and looking at subsequently the break to lower lows. But what is interesting is that copper actually bounced off 250. And when you really look bigger picture on this chart, looking back for the last 5 years, that price level actually is a pretty significant, well, at least it's a technical support. And so copper really hasn't actually yet broken down in the biggest way. And so now we've got a bit of a bounce in copper. I still am quite bearish. I think that copper is going lower, especially in the turn of an economic cycle when we inevitably get a true global economic recession. But at least at this moment, the trend has, at least the break has not happened yet. I'm still waiting for that big floodgate to open on the downside of copper. It would be a technical break below that 250. Nonetheless, I wanted to move on to the precious metals. And what I have in the pages 4 and 5 are the charts on platinum and palladium. And what I wanted to observe here on platinum was the fact that it never really broke out on the upside initially with gold, silver, and the other precious metals. And it stayed in this very tight trade range, basically well below its 2017 consolidation lows. But then just 2 weeks ago, we just had this enormous breakout that really ushered in a huge technical event in platinum. And it really asks the question, are we seeing the beginning of some much bigger picture turn that might be a new bull run in the platinum market? And on page 5, what was interesting is that even though palladium has been in this trade range for the majority of 2019, that really does look like an ascending triangle, like a consolidation, sideways consolidation that is now seeing palladium prices trying to break out to 52-week new highs and actually even multi-year highs. And it really asks the question, are we about to see another major leg higher in this precious metals?
Patrick, let's look at the other precious metals charts and see what we see there in terms of correlations that might give us a clue as to where platinum is headed.
Sure. Well, this is where I have that chart on silver. And we looked at gold, and I want to look at gold again with all of our listeners and in just a second. But silver, just on a percentage basis, had just an extraordinary run in an incredibly short order. At first, even though gold was doing very well, silver seemed to be a massive laggard and simply did not seem to catch the bid at all. And suddenly, right at the start of the summer, we had a big breakout candle come in on silver, and it ushered a move from $15 to almost $20 on the upside. But I think the technical significance of what I wanted to highlight on this chart is that for much of 2017 and a huge chunk of 2018, the major trade range of silver was within the $16 to $17.50 range. And as a technician, I would naturally anticipate that this would act as some form of a resistance level or a consolidation level for the silver breakout. But what was amazing is it only took 4 or 5 weeks of price action for silver basically to blow right through that range and head right up towards 19.5 plus on the upside. And that to me is showing some real bullish technical sign of life. As a technician, what I would definitely be seeing here is that any corrections, which I think we are overdue for a little bit of backfilling here, I fully anticipate that $17 trade range area that it's highlighted to actually act now as a support and probably contain almost all the major correction for the next buying opportunity.
Well, Patrick, I'm particularly keen to get your perspective on gold on pages 7 and 8 because, you know, clearly we're seeing what looks like some kind of topping here, but are we going to get a pullback all the way back down to 1377? Boy, that would be great. Or are we looking at maybe not that far before this bottoms out and moves higher?
For sure. Well, first of all, what I wanted to do is this is where I wanted to talk a little bit about gold, the cycles of gold, and then I wanted to get into gold miners and talk about an update on what I presented to the Macro Voice Live listeners out in Toronto last year. So what I wanted to start with here on page 7 is simply looking at the last phase of the gold bull market that lasted from the 2008 lows all the way through the 2011 peak. And when we had in 2008 into 2009 a consolidation that lasted a year plus on the end, it acted, it had a substantial overhead resistance around the 1,000 level. And when that technical level broke, which I consider very similar to when gold broke out above 1350, that it ushered in the next bull phase. And arguably, that's what we may be witnessing here. But what I wanted to highlight to everybody is that in spite of that being the start of the gold bull market, over the subsequent 2 years, gold had 4 very distinct market pauses or corrections of the bull trend that lasted multiple weeks, if not months, of backfilling of the primary trend. And I think this is significant because when we go to page 8, where we actually look at today's gold breakout, I'm highly suspect that while I do believe that we are in a new gold bull market, that I think that this first phase is played out and some form of a consolidation of gold here is very likely in order. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I definitely think that I wouldn't even say just a consolidation. I think that we're overdue on a technical basis for a pullback. The thing is, each time we see it starting to happen, and I think there have been 3 or 4 false starts where it looked really clear to me, like, okay, I can see it in this chart. It's really about to let go. We're about to move down. And sure enough, it's really starting to move down. And then all of a sudden, there's yet another bit of news, you know, a little manner of a trade war here or a risk of a shooting war there, and gold goes shooting up dramatically on that news. And what I notice is each of those times that gold goes up, I mean, boy, it really just with huge exuberance goes up. And each time I'm expecting the pullback to accelerate, just as it was about to accelerate, we get more news. And so I don't know whether gold's just a heck of a lot stronger than I was expecting, or if we just need to wait this out. And I do think there's going to be lower prices and better buying opportunities than we've seen in the last couple of weeks. But how much lower? That really is the operative question.
Right. So what I wanted to do now is give all of our listeners an update. Now, it was just over a year ago in the summer of 2018 when we were doing Macro Voices live in Toronto. And actually, Luke Groman and Jeff Snyder were both actually present at that one. And we both did our presentations. And I did a presentation on these commodity stock cycles. Particularly, I highlighted the gold miners ETF and the cycles that it has gone through. And what I did was I measured out the average length of a rise and a fall within a cycle of the gold miners higher and lower. The interesting observation that I wanted to point out is that of the 8 cycles that were measured from trough to peak and then subsequent peak back down to trough, the average length of the advance was about 9.62 months. And the average length of the decline was about 9.5 months. And I find that very interesting because for me, when I hear a lot of value investors and a lot of long-term investors, they always talk about catching, well, you think of the business cycle, you know, like a 7-year trend or something like this. But what's amazing is that these mining stocks seem to have these cycles that all tend to last far less than a year. And what is also fascinating is about the magnitude of those rises. The average rise on a GDX gold miners run was about 88%, and the average decline, a staggering 45% loss. And to illustrate this, I highlighted the last 2 legs of the cycle, which was on page 10, where I'm showing that the decline from September of 2017 high down to the September 2018 low was about a 12-month decline that was about a 32% peak to trough decline. And subsequently, after that September low, we have now gone through about a 12-month rise in the GDX, which has been about a 79% rise from trough to peak. And what is interesting is if we compare that to those cycle measurements, then what we can identify is that both of these cycles have been a little bit longer than the average, and they've also been more shallow in their magnitude than the average move. And I just also wanted to point out that the current rise in the GDX is not confirmed to have peaked. We haven't seen a turn in that cycle. So theoretically, the GDX can still spurt even higher and longer because we haven't officially started some new trough cycle in there. But where I wanted to go with this, Eric, was that during that presentation, and I subsequently did the same presentation with some updated numbers at the Toronto Money Show in September of last year. And what I highlighted there was the what I called the mispricing of long-term options relative to these commodity cycles. And at the time, I specifically highlighted the GDX January 2020 long-term option, which was priced at $2.55. And what's interesting is after doing that presentation, when we look at this current commodity cycle, the bull market phase of this GDX run on the upside, that $2.50 option traded as high as $12.50 in this cycle, just some phenomenal returns. And what I'm going to be doing at that money show and on a video that I've done for my members is go through how to utilize these long-dated options to trade these commodity cycles. And anybody that wants to learn more about that can certainly come out and see me present on that.
Okay, Patrick, so I just want to make sure that we're clear. Is this the subject that you'll be covering when you speak next week, September 21st, at the All Stars of Options at the Money Show?
Exactly. And so listeners can download the chart book and see my speaking schedules there. And I'm going to be covering both the commodity cycles for commodity stocks broadly, and as well a specific presentation on leveraging the gold and silver bull market using these option cycles. And so I'll be focused on that, and I'll explain how options work during that session. The Money Show is running on September 20th and 21st in Toronto. It's free to attend. So anyone who wants to come out and watch the presentations, please make sure you come out and see me.
Okay, that's great for our listeners who can get to Toronto, but what about the people who can't make it to Toronto?
Thanks for asking that. So Eric, any one of our listeners that wants to see the presentation and can't make it out to the Money Show, it is available in the members section at Big Picture Trading. So anybody who accesses a 14-day complimentary free trial to the website can view it under the bonus content. So anyone who registers for that, then you can immediately get an email sending you the video, and you're welcome to watch the online version of it.
Okay, Patrick, thanks so much for that. Today's episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy of The Many Flavors of Trend Following and subscribe to their podcast as well. You can also listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen. That's in your Macro Voices feed from last week. Be sure also to go to macrovoices.com to register your free account so you receive our Research Roundup email, which contains links to all of the best content we can find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find a link to the transcript for today's interview with Jeff and Luke, as well as the chart book that we discussed here in the postgame. There's also an interesting article from the head of BlackRock who says $70 trillion of cash is sitting idle as opportunities dry up, as well as an article that Russia considers the possibility of $25 oil next year. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.